I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Amazon, the online everything store with the arrow-headed smile in its logo, is ready to build its second headquarters outside Seattle this time in a post-industrial urban dreamscape. And there's barely an American city out there that isn't begging to be it. 50,000 ultra-smart tech jobs in the 100K pay range are the prize. But to win the nod from CEO Jeff Bezos, they say, is some combination of smart local workforce, an affordable standard of living, and tax breaks galore. So we squint our eyes over this coast-to-coast bidding contest to see the outline, if we can, of jobs and the workplace coming next. A raging hunger for work itself drives a race that most contestants will lose and that a master of monopoly has already won. To get a sense of the spot cities are on, we went north in the rain this week to Haverhill, Massachusetts, on the Merrimack River between Lowell and Lawrence. Haverhill was in on the first industrial boom in the U.S., making shoes. Mayor Jim Fiorentini made clear he wants to be in on a post-industrial boom, but there is caution in his voice. He's a sometime prosecutor and labor lawyer, a people's Democrat who would remind you of Tip O'Neill.
Cities and states are falling all over themselves now to give Amazon a big tax break, and so will we, because we need to be competitive. But really, they ought to at least consider a federal law banning us from doing this stuff, because these companies ought to pay their fair share. We have to offer them a big break so that we're competitive. But if nobody could do it, it'd be a different story.
Jim, I think of you as every mayor of, now it turns out, hundreds of cities around this country. Describe this scramble for one company.
I woke up the morning that they had this. My wife is my chief advisor.
Good.
And she read that Amazon was applying, and she immediately kicked me and said, "You got to get in this. You got to apply. Absolutely." So I grabbed my economic development director. I called him and said, "I want an application. I want it tomorrow. Get that application." I also called the mayor of the next city over, Dan Rivera, over in Lawrence. And I said, "It just doesn't make sense to have every mayor in the whole country submitting a proposal. Let's do a regional proposal. Maybe that gives us more strength."
What I'm remembering is that 100 years ago today, I read that one in every 10 American-made shoes came out of Haverhill.
Haverhill, Massachusetts, absolutely. The top woman shoe manufacturer in the entire world. At one time, 12,000 people in Haverhill, 10,000, worked downtown in the shoe factories. And right across from where we're standing was a place called the Ornstein Heel Factory. We have had an incredible turnaround where we have now 850 new residents in our downtown and what were once shoe factories. Shoe factories were all abandoned as of about 14 years ago when I took office. And now there's 550 new units, 850 new residents. And to me, it's bittersweet because on the one hand, I'm thrilled to see these old buildings reused. But on the other hand, boy, it was so much better when they made things there. Mm. When the people would come, my grandparents who worked in the shoe and textile mills, when they would come from overseas, work here, be able to walk to work, mm-hmm. and they built the city and they built the American middle class. I like to say that the shoe workers, like my grandparents, saved enough money to send their children to college and their grandson to law school.
The need, the hunger, the pleading, it makes me nervous.
It makes me nervous, too. I am philosophically opposed to giving big tax breaks to companies like Amazon. They can easily afford to pay their own way. However, we have to compete. Every mayor in the country did the same thing I did, woke up that morning and said, "We need that 50,000 jobs," and they're all making proposals, so we have to do the same thing. We got a great company called Southwick to come here.
Yes.
Every Brooks Brothers suit made in America is made in Haverhill, Massachusetts. We were able to recruit Southwick. We worked with the Romney administration. We reached out to them, met with them, talked with them, and did what I'm philosophically opposed to doing. We offered them a big tax break, not because I wanted to, but because they were going to go overseas, we were going to lose those jobs. Southwick at that time was in Lawrence, and it's now 550 jobs in Haverhill. Amazon would be like having 100 Southwicks. Mm. So that's why we're working so hard on it.
I keep wondering in this whole thing, including the Globe's fronting for Amazon and Jeff Bezos, who really has any leverage here?
Nobody. Not in my opinion. I think Amazon will do what's good for Amazon.
If you're Jeff Bezos, where would you take your company?
Oh, I'd take it right to Massachusetts. Absolutely. Massachusetts has the best educated workforce in the country. If Massachusetts were a country, we would be one of the top educated countries in the whole world. The same reason that GE came here, not because GE got the best tax breaks. New York offered them twice the tax breaks. They came because of the ambiance. They came because of the educated workforce. And that's what we can offer them.
Does Jeff Bezos know the labor history of this part of the world, including the famous Lawrence strike,
which my grandfather was in?
Good for him. And Haverhill, at the time, had a socialist mayor.
They did indeed.
This is appropriately fighting working class part of the world.
One of the reasons they say, it was long before my time, that Western Electric left here and went to North Andover is because of the working class history in Haverhill. But that's all ancient history. Nobody even remembers that here in Haverhill.
Nobody remembers unions, practically. And I don't think Jeff Bezos can spell union. Are we concerned or?
No. Concerned about what? They say they're going to offer good jobs with good benefits, 50,000 jobs with an average salary of 100,000 each. We want them. We are an easily affordable city with a very reasonable tax rate. We are the greatest city in the Commonwealth, and we're working on becoming the greatest city in the world. Move to Haverhill. You'll see the best restaurant zone north of the North End. Come on up here and give us a shot. And call me when you're here. I'll take you out for a cup of coffee.
That's Mayor Jim Fiorentini in Haverhill. Every city has a version of that pitch. Coming up here, Mayor Marty Walsh of Boston and slick videos sent into Amazon from all over the map.
You're talking about 50,000 jobs. You're talking about $4 billion of investment and development in the city. That would probably be the biggest project we have in Massachusetts or in Boston, in the history of Boston.
We are a talent magnet. 3 out of the last 6 years, the Tampa Bay area has created more jobs than any place else in the state of Florida. This place rocks.
So Alexa, where is the best place for Amazon to locate its second world headquarters?
Danbury, Connecticut.
I told you so.
You've probably heard something about Pittsburgh, the city that built America, the city that built the world.
Detroiters are born moving. Our wings have a deep history. Our roads pave the way for every future highway of tomorrow. An international hub full of vitality, of Michigan strength, from the global reach of techno and Motown to the powerful rev of our engines. From style trends to technology, Detroit is the starting line of the world's imagination.
Lester Spence teaches political science and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. In conversation this week, he picked right up on that video to Amazon from his home city, Detroit.
In the case like Detroit or Baltimore, they look to Amazon to basically replace the manufacturing sector that fled these cities decades ago.
Right.
And cities like Detroit and Baltimore are supposed to basically bend over backwards to fight for Amazon. Hell, I mean, Newark, the state of New Jersey offered Amazon approximately $7 billion in tax incentives to move to Newark. I don't think they've ever given a package that big, and that's the kind of the price cities pay. Once cities are forced / incentivized to turn towards downtown development, they basically bend over backwards for all these entities in order to come. So in the case of the sports stadiums, you know, these wealthy owners don't really have to pay anything for the sports stadiums and they collect all the profit. When it comes to downtown development, real estate developers are given really, really powerful tax benefits. And then when you're talking about employees like Amazon, you're talking about basically selling the city off in order to get Amazon to come. And we know from research that whatever resources these entities provide, they very, very rarely trickle down to working class, poor income residents. They rarely even trickle down into middle income residents. You know, and then when you think about race, those benefits are also going to be disproportionately going to go to white residents. So you take a city like Detroit. Detroit is still kind of coming out from under bankruptcy. And they put together this powerful video. And in fact, the woman whose voice is on the video, her name is Jessica Caramore, I know Jessica. Jessica's one of the most important poets of her generation, and she's absolutely wonderful. Mm. It's her voice on this video basically selling the city. Like, this is what Detroit stands for. This is why you should choose us.
And this is what Detroit has done. She's saying, we were the global capital of the manufacturing century. That's a very big deal. Let's get on to the next one.
Yeah, and the thing is, that's absolutely right. There is no city more important to the development of the 20th century as we know it than Detroit.
Thank you.
There is no city more important. Detroit was Silicon Valley before Silicon Valley was
Silicon
Valley.
Amen.
So now the pitch is like, wow, we've got this empty space. We've got all this opportunity. We're on an international border. You know, if you're in downtown Detroit, you can look right over the river and see Canada, right? We've got the international airport. We've got the university infrastructure. We've got all these folks who are qualified for employment or whatever. Come, come, come. Now, the thing is, for Detroit, that's kind of a long shot.
Hmm.
Newark, Baltimore, Detroit, St. Louis, most of the cities that are pitching to Amazon, they're really long shots. And what struck me, besides the fact that this just reproduces this idea that the only way cities can make it is by basically throwing public money at private billionaires, is the fact that this constitutes the radical imagination. Like, this is the moonshot. Like, oh my God, getting Amazon, as opposed to kind of radically imagining how cities are supposed to function, how police are supposed to act in cities like Detroit and Baltimore, radically imagining how resources are spent. And that's the thing that really, really struck me.
Lester Spence will have more to say before this hour is done. Coming up, Franklin Foer, the two-time New Republic editor with a remarkable book on the cosmic risk, he says, in what those tech billionaires are thinking and planning, risks for civilization and the human species. We'll have more city politics, too. This is Open Source. Shirley Kressel is our model citizen in Boston, grandmother in the Back Bay neighborhood, who has trained her critical eye on every public hearing around development projects in this city for decades now. Shirley, you remind everybody of the late, great Jane Jacobs for acuity and passion about cities. And you put it all in a wonderful comment that the New York Times published on this Amazon race. The Globe hasn't published it yet. Pick up wherever you want on what Jim Fiorentini and Lester Spence were just saying.
Well, I've been watching these races to the bottom and corporate welfare in Boston and other cities for decades. And I can say two things. The money will not sway the decision.
The tax breaks?
The tax breaks, mm-hmm. Yeah. None of these subsidies are really part of the business decision. And we've seen this already, and the mayors and city councils here have seen this already with Fidelity and Liberty Mutual and General Electric. They know that the money is just a shakedown. It's just gravy. They do it because the companies ask for that because they know that they can get it. And the reason they can get it is because it serves them so much. It's pocket change to them. The politicians want it. Because these are mayors who don't really know what to do for their cities, and they think that they can claim credit for, quote, creating jobs and landing companies and luring them in, when in actual fact they know from their own experience that that there's a huge literature that documents that these corporate decisions are made on the basis of a skilled workforce and quality of life and amenity and infrastructure. Those are real business decisions.
Why doesn't somebody just snap through the fog there and clear it up? No, we're not going to pay you. That's what you suggested.
Yeah, well, San Antonio did that. They said, blindly giving away the store is not our style, and they backed away.
Hold it there, and we'll come back to you, Shirley. But I'm dying to introduce the writer, Franklin Foer, on the line from Washington. You've written a stunning book, Frank, on this grand and underreported monopoly power, wealth, of course, but ambition, deeply considered and networked intentions of men like Jeff Bezos at Amazon and his counterparts at Google and Facebook, lords of a changing universe. Your book titled World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. Short form, as I read it, these men have a plan, and inside the plan, some very, very big ideas. Welcome, Frank Foer.
Very kind of you. Thank you.
Can I just say, for listeners who just landed, speak of the scale, the wealth, the novelty of these still young companies. Google, market cap 10 times bigger than General Motors.
Well, let's just begin with the ways in which they've become so deeply embedded in our lives, and the ways in which we consume, in the ways in which we filter reality. These companies stand between us and reality. They provide us with news, culture, entertainment. We give them our most precious secrets. They're all right now in an arms race to become our personal assistant so that they can wake us up in the morning and they can lead us through our day. And the companies have just amassed giant concentrations of power. Power that they hold over markets, power that they hold over information, power that they hold over our public square and therefore our democracy. But the point that I think you're calling attention to is that these companies have a vision for the human species. And because of their economic power, they're able to poke and prod us and actually lead us in quite rapid fashion to their ultimate vision for what the human species should become.
Yeah, there's an idea here, maybe 30, 40 years, but you say it goes back to Descartes, Leibniz. But part of the project, even 30 years ago, was to attack copyright, attack the gatekeepers, the old authorities in print, and first by challenging their ownership of anything, their own creation.
Right.
Who figured that out? First, we'll go after copyright.
Right. So one of the things that these companies wanted to do was they wanted to aggressively collapse the value of knowledge. You'll remember one of the mantras from the 1990s was that information wants to be free, which was a utopian hope of Silicon Valley. But it was also, in a way, something that was exploited by Silicon Valley for economic gain. And so the theory, the business theory of the case, was that if these companies could make all information on the internet free, they could then apply their tools to filter that for the entire world, because the internet would be a mess were it not for the tools that help us sort and make sense of it. And so things like Google and Facebook are so very, very powerful because they take this huge sea that is the world's stockpile of information, and they provide it with hierarchy. And providing it with hierarchy is this in essence the source of their power, that these are the companies that are able to pick the winners and losers in the world. Whatever shows up first in a Google search is the most information, the most important information. Whatever shows up highest in a Facebook news feed is going to become the topic of conversation in politics and society. Whatever shows up highest in an Amazon search is going to be the product that's most likely to be consumed. So it's in their world, everybody becomes increasingly dependent on these platforms. So not just for information, but for the people who actually produce information, we're highly dependent on these platforms. We need these platforms in order to reach adequate audience in order to monetize our product. And we're caught in this vicious circle where the value of knowledge and information has been declining, and therefore, in order to make up for that decline in value, we need to increase demand for that information. So we have to reach much vaster audiences, which again is what these platforms enable.
So you're right, I think, that 65-70% of people's news nowadays arrives by social media.
That's correct.
They are a gatekeeper as there has never been a gatekeeper before, including the churches or much less newspapers or network television.
Right.
So what do they want to do with it, Frank? What's their dream?
Well, there's the practical business part of it, which is that social media would like to capture your attention for as long as possible. And then there's an idealistic dream that comes attached with it, which is that Mark Zuckerberg talks about the dream of tying the world together into a global village. And there is something beautiful and lyrical about that dream. It's a dream that traces back to the counterculture of the 1960s into the ideal of the communes. Because let's remember that the tech industry was born in the peninsula, the mid-peninsula of San Francisco, which was the same place that also gave us, you know, Apple computers and the internet came from the same place as LSD, the Grateful Dead,
interesting,
and Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters. And those two things rubbed off on one another.
Stuart Brand, the whole Earth catalog.
Yeah, exactly. And so there is an incredible amount of idealism that exists in these companies, even as they're kind of diabolically going about the process of trying to gobble up as much of your attention as possible through whatever means possible.
Go back to what you were saying about Mark Zuckerberg. He says, effectively, the engineering mindset, like his own, Harvard trained, plus algorithms, can make anything better and transform the world, transform us from the inside.
Yes. Yeah. So,
and there are you know, genetic biologists who will happily accept big money from those guys to do it, to experiment with it.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, there's, you know, part of the problem is that there's, you have engineers who have this view of the world, which is that it exists as a giant system, and their role is to build the most efficient system as possible. Hmm. And in the course of building that system, they tend to neglect the fact that human beings occupy it, and they sometimes can't be reduced to data, and sometimes they have ethics and politics and emotions that resist that shouldn't be reduced to the systems that they've designed. It's not just an engineering mindset. There's a view of humanity that's embedded within it as well.
And as what?
Which is if you listen to a lot of people in Silicon Valley talk about the human being, about what is an individual human, they tend to think of us as machines. Hmm. That we're pieces of code, just giant piles of algorithm within the hardware of the human skeleton, the human frame. And that's why it makes perfect sense for us to merge with their machines, because that's just the natural course for human evolution. For us, we're already cyborg, and for us to merge with the machine is to fulfill the destiny of human evolution. Now, of course, there's an inherent problem with this, because, all right, so tools have always been an extension of human beings. You could argue that technology is one of the things that makes us fundamentally human as a human species, and we've had hammers and we've had plows and we've automated upper body strength in order in factories. But what's happening is that they're automating intellectual processes. And when we're merging with these machines, we're not just merging with tools, we're merging with the companies that operate the machines.
Frank, this is all fascinating to me. But there are other big themes I'd like you to touch on, intellectual notions. Monopolies, says Peter Thiel, are good. Competition is destructive and bad. Also, journalism is over. Journalism is all really about clicks, mind reading, reading your mind more than it's informing it, surveillance, marketing, control. Expand on a couple of those and we'll keep going.
Okay. Well, let's just start with the idea of monopoly because it's so fundamental. Because there's a view of power that's embedded in this vision. And we talked a little bit about the ways in which a lot of Silicon Valley grew out of the counterculture. And a lot of the fundamental concepts of Silicon Valley grew out of the counterculture. So you have this idea of the network, and you have this idea of crowdsourcing and social media. And it's essentially this beautiful dream about how the world could be stitched into one. And in this utopia of the network, we would realize our relationship to our fellow human beings in an almost ecological sort of way, where we would be able to acquire a new consciousness. And it's like I said, there's a lot of beauty in that dream, but there's a problem, which is that the network also presented one of the greatest business opportunities in capitalism. And so it was almost inevitable that the network would be attacked by firms and then captured by firms. And suddenly when you have this one monolithic structure of the network, it becomes the basis for monopoly.
Hold it there, Frank. I want to introduce Ben Tarnoff, who joins us in the studio. He started writing out about politics and culture in his hometown, San Francisco, since the Gold Rush. With his wife, Maura Weigel, he started the magazine Logic, and he continues to write about technology and other things for The Guardian website, where he reviewed your book, Frank. I don't want you to review the book again, Ben, but I'm dying to hear your take on the general theme of a huge, bigger-than-human notion inside all of this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me. I think it's useful that we're having this conversation, right? Because as Frank is alluding to, for decades, Silicon Valley has sold us this idea with great success, really this gospel of techno-utopianism, that the internet in particular would always and everywhere be a force for human liberation. And really, I would say in the past several months, particularly since the Trump election, that narrative seems to be breaking down. You've seen the media turn a much sharper, more skeptical eye on how these platforms operate, how they're run, how they organize information.
The straight media or the new media or both?
The mainstream media. I mean, I think you've seen a whole spate of fascinating articles in places like The Times and The Post on the subject. I think this is a moment of great political possibility where we can have these conversations. But I think we also have to be careful not to invert techno-utopianism to arrive at a techno-dystopianism, right? That we have to take a breath and think about what are the positive aspects that these tools have produced. And I think one of those aspects is that, you know, and I think I'm a bit of a contrarian on the subject, but I do think that social media, for instance, has played a positive role in American political life.
I think so too. I mean, intuitively, young people communicating about the otherwise ignored Bernie campaign, for example, couldn't have been done without social media, right?
Absolutely. I mean, look, it cuts both ways, but there are political ideas, political traditions that would not have received a hearing in the mainstream media, that would never have made it past the editorial board of the New York Times, that can actually find a community of people on social media, that can actually politicize people. Young people can arrive at those ideas for the first time.
Things that don't pass the Times muster. For example, the idiocy, the folly of the war in Iraq. They were all in it. And that, I must say, Frank, killed my nostalgia for those institutional authorities that you still miss. I mean, I would say the unanimous media support for George Bush's war, New York Times, Dan Rather, The New Republic too, Frank, did more than the internet did to discredit and undo the beloved old media. But I'm also getting over my own techno-utopianism. The blogging decade liberated a lot of strong new voices, but it has not recreated a national conversation yet. Do you know why not, Ben, and can it be done?
Well, I think, look, we're clearly in a moment where the old consensus is cracking up and a new one is slowly being formed. I think the media is obviously being transformed quite radically. All I would say is that I think it is productive and it provides an opportunity for the left to have these institutions available, to have technologies available where we can form a kind of alternative public sphere. Obviously, it also offers opportunities to racist, fascist, and other very ugly ideas that have been banished from the mainstream media for good reason. So I'm not saying this is necessarily a positive political development, but it does provide opportunities, and I think we've seen it pay real dividends in the campaign of Bernie Sanders, in the campaign of Jeremy
Corbyn. I was looking for another
Corbyn.
Example beyond Bernie-ism. Corbyn, you say.
Corbyn, I would say the impact of social media on the Corbyn campaign was probably even greater than it was on the Bernie Sanders campaign. You know, you had a study coming out of the London School of Economics that broke down just the level of negativity that Corbyn and Labour faced in the mainstream British press. I mean, just a level of hostility that I think it's hard for us to imagine.
So, something to celebrate there, Frank, for or not?
Yeah, I actually don't entirely disagree with what Ben's saying. And I don't think that we need – I agree that you know, even though I wrote a very harsh critique of Silicon Valley and of these companies, I actually do believe that there is some emancipatory and liberating possibility within the internet and within social media. But the problem is that the reality of so much social media is concentration. It's this overwhelming power that Facebook has, and that Facebook is not it's not a democratic medium. It's a command and control medium.
Can it thwart the natural spontaneous exchange among like-minded young people?
I think it can. I mean, I think it. So, all right, among young people, I mean, we're talking about there's two separate conversations here. There's the possibility that social media can encourage or can provide a platform for people to reach each other and stay in touch with one another to fuel social movements. And there's some examples of that happening, and that's important. But the reality is that there's this much broader political culture that's getting news and information from Facebook. And it creates kind of this intellectual incapacitation that allows fake news propaganda.
Hold it there, Frank. We're going to come back on this. Coming up, we're rethinking the Boston Globe's cheerleading wraparound Dear Jeff letter to the CEO of Amazon. This is Open Source. We're shuttling between what Amazon's second headquarters could do for your city and what Amazon and an ultra-tech mindset driving Google and Facebook as well is doing to our minds and souls, our culture, our world. I want everybody to hear more from our Detroiter in Baltimore, Lester Spence. I told him about this huge Dear Jeff letter that the Boston Globe wrapped around its big Sunday edition 2 weeks ago, tugging at the hem of Jeff Bezos about what Boston's all about and what we might all do together. And I asked Lester Spence, would he write his own letter on behalf of either Baltimore or Detroit?
To Jeff Bezos?
Sure.
No. You know why not? And this is really important. Jeff Bezos, and I don't know Jeff personally. I know somebody went to high school with him, but I don't know Jeff Bezos personally. We're a democracy, right? Now, granted, our economic system is capitalist, but we're a democracy. Under what condition should I be writing a letter to a billionaire imploring him or her to move to my city? Why would that even be a thing that I would want to do, right? Again, that's common sense now. Like, if I were to go outside and, you know, go into the neighborhood of right next to Hopkins and tell people that that's crazy, they would think I was crazy. they would think I was crazy. Like, why wouldn't you want Amazon to come? And hell, I buy all Amazon stuff. I got an Amazon Fire. I got 5 Amazon Echoes at the crib. I get that. But the thing is, there is no condition under which doing that actually benefits a city. Because what happens once you get him, his priorities totally change the city's priorities. And the city's priorities end up being about what can we do to make Jeff Bezos happy? What can we do to make Amazon happy? And the only thing that makes them happy is more profit.
So you save your ink to Jeff Bezos. He writes you a letter. Dear Lester, what can we do for you?
You can stop listening to all my conversations with all them Amazon Echoes you got in my crib. But what Jeff Bezos can do, and this is actually where capital does matter, is what he can do is argue strongly that they need to pay more in taxes. What he can do is argue strongly that cities like Boston shouldn't have to rely on corporate largesse in order to take care of its residents. What he could do is say, like, wow, me as an individual, Republicans are talking about tax cuts. Like, no, we need to actually increase taxes on people like me. Instead of potentially killing the estate tax, you actually need to increase the estate tax. That's what he can do. What he can do is say, you know what, for firms that relocate outside of the country and still want to claim tax cuts within the United States, get rid of those tax cuts. That's what he can do.
That was Lester Spence. Ben Tarnoff, speaking from your own West Coast origins and history, what can Amazon do for its cities like Seattle? Not everybody loves him in Seattle, but he's had a huge impact. What could we expect?
Well, I mean, I think we could probably expect the worst, but I mean, we could demand, for instance, that when Amazon lands wherever they land, that they abide by certain rules that the community sets, right? That, for instance, for their warehouse workers, right, who are typically poorly paid, overworked, often contract workers, we could demand that those are full-time employees with benefits and that they will not interfere with their right to organize. We could demand certain diversity commitments, that they will diversify their workforce. You know, Amazon's workforce at the engineering level remains overwhelmingly white and male. Of course, this is a problem throughout the tech industry, but it is pronounced at Amazon. So these are the types of commitments that as a community, as a political community, we could demand.
Right.
Maybe not at the municipal level. It's obviously difficult with the race to the bottom that Shirley mentioned, but certainly at a regional or at a national level, the political situation doesn't look promising for that, unfortunately.
Shirley, you know, I'm just thinking Jeff Bezos, if he wanted to, could not just put money into the Boston Public Schools, say, but he could put incredible sophistication of his technology about education, learning, human mind, into a huge project that you could see from the moon. And it would cost him a rounding error in terms of his multi-billions. Why can't we dangle that ambition in front of him?
That's the last thing we should let him do. I mean, we've already
I'm not asking him to come in like Zuckerberg in Newark,
right,
and take it over, but say, okay, there's some fundamental, you know, missed opportunities in this town, and we'd love to open them all up.
We don't want him making public policy. We don't want him making educational policy. What qualifies him to do that? Because he made a lot of money by not paying taxes? We already have the best education in this state, and we could have the best education in this city if the mayors of the city really wanted it. They don't. That's why we don't have it. It's not because we don't have any money or models, or we don't know what to do. And what Bezos is doing is I was thinking about why is he even asking for tax breaks? Because the last thing they need is these few more dollars to throw into their vast pit of money. And I think it's just a way to get the city to its knees in front of him. Because when he comes here, I think he'll choose Boston. Because, A, it meets his business need criteria, you know, for a skilled workforce, quality of life, all the things that businesses really want. And it's cool in the same way. And it's very much like Seattle. I lived in Seattle for a while also. And it's a kind of a place that has everything he needs and yet is diffident enough that he knows he can ride roughshod over us. And he can bend Boston to his will just as he did Seattle. And it became his city, and this would become his city. And that asking for that tribute up front is just a way of getting the mayor to say, yes, we're yours. Do what you will.
Frank Forrest, she's talking about a very human, extreme, dare I say, male ego thing in all this tribute. What do you think?
I think it's there. I think that there are a couple other things I wanted to just call attention to with regards to the Amazon headquarters. The first is that these companies bring with them tremendous inequality, that they are they pay their workers extremely well because they're sitting on top of monopolistic profits. And part of the way in which they're able to seal up their monopoly is that they go around and they spend professional sports level salaries on the best AI and virtual reality engineers, and they try to lock them up so that those guys don't go and try to start up companies that might dethrone Amazon. And so what you see in places like Seattle and San Francisco is tremendous inequality between the workers who are at the monopolistic firm like Amazon and all the other white collar and especially blue collar workers in the city. And so if they arrive in Boston, that's the fate. It's like you're going to have the divisions in the city, which are already probably pretty immense, are going to grow even more immense. And one of the things about monopoly is that one of the dangers of monopoly that Thomas Jefferson predicted, that's been a core part of the American political tradition, is that we fear corporate power because we fear the way in which it can influence the democratic outcomes. And so when a company is able to leverage the power of the state to further increase its advantages over its competitors, we're witnessing something that's profoundly anti-democratic.
You know, there's a nice little point in your book, Frank, that monopoly rules and young tech geniuses don't even think about taking on Amazon. They want to have a clever idea that Amazon will buy and fit into their monopoly. We're talking about something enormous here. One of the wits in our radio gang said, paraphrasing Frederick Jameson on capitalism, he said, it's easier to imagine the end of Boston than the end of Amazon.
Oof. Painfully.
Give Zach Goldhammer credit for that one. You had a personal experience at the New Republic with Chris Hughes, who was a roommate of Mark Zuckerberg's at Harvard, made tons of money, bought the New Republic, and you got a lesson in journalism. I wish you'd just spell it out, how, you know, Walter Lippmann's thoughtful essays of the 20s or whenever, World War I time, became, you know, a clickbait game.
Well, really one of the problems with dominant platforms is that we become dependent on the platform, and the values of the platform become our values. And so in journalism, in much of journalism, we set out to do very noble things, but we also exist, you know, many of us, not all of us, exist in a world where you have to produce revenue. And if you produce revenue in this day and age, it means you've got to provide web traffic. And where does web traffic come from? It comes from two primary sources. You've got Google and you've got Facebook. And so, in order to succeed in that game, you have to do essentially what it is that those platforms demand. And so with Facebook, what Facebook demands is that you produce for this giant audience, and its algorithms reward certain things. And what I found at the New Republic was that we ended up gravitating towards, it was a magazine that had, has lots of its own shares of problems, but it made a fetish of originality. And with Facebook, you have the opposite. It's all about latching on to the thing that's popular, and you're trying to tap into the emotions of users, the things that give them pleasure, the things that give them anxiety. And with all the data that's available, with all the power that Facebook has amassed, you end up shifting your core in order to try to appease the platform master. And you try to latch onto the thing that's popular while it's on the trailhead of its ascent. And so that means that in a lot of media, there's a creeping sameness, conformism, in terms of the topic, in terms of the style.
Right, the news cycle, the whole thing. Let me just say, we don't have enough time in this hour. We'll come back to it, but to solve this problem. But I wanted to just try out, the notion is out there that we got to bring back Thurman Arnold, Franklin Roosevelt's trust buster, you know, really take on monopoly, enforce those rules again. There's another fanciful, in your book notion, Frank, that we got to learn from the slow food movement, artisanal thinking, privacy, the joys of, being direct together. What's the hope? And I'd love your thought on this, Ben. Where are we going to stem this tide?
Well, it's going to take a massive political mobilization. I mean, we're talking about companies that are, by market cap, some of the biggest in the world. They have a massive lobbying presence in Washington. As Frank is mentioning, they penetrate every aspect of our lives. So you can imagine the type of political movement one would have to build.
I've been dying to ask, what is the politics of their movement? They seem to adore Barack Obama, who kind of returned the favor.
Of course. I mean, the relationship between Obama and Google was extremely close. There was a revolving door between those two. Silicon Valley has traditionally been a core donor base for the Democratic Party. Certainly high tech has been very important to the Democratic Party since the 1980s. Mm-hmm. I think the question now is, where is the political movement going to come from that can actually confront the tech industry? Because the Democratic Party is quite reliant on Silicon Valley cash. So it'll be an interesting battle to watch as this liberal antitrust movement gains steam. Can they actually sever this link between the Democratic Party establishment and Silicon Valley?
Have you got a leader?
Well, there are some promising figures that are emerging. Ro Khanna has emerged. He's from Silicon Valley. He took a lot of tech industry money, but he's been I would say, very progressive on a lot of these issues. He's embraced a lot of antitrust rhetoric. I think there's going to be bigger political difficulties in convincing people to join this movement, because most people like the tech industry and most people like the convenience and efficiency and low consumer prices provided by these platforms.
Last question. Will they take it on the dollars and cents, the money monopoly issues, or some of the philosophical issues that Frank has written about?
I think it's going to be difficult to build a mass political movement around the philosophical issues. I mean, if we're talking about the early 20th century, right, the late 19th century, the way you get farmers to become radicals is because they can't get their crop to market without paying extortionary rates to the railroad companies. We're not living quite in that moment. I mean, I share all of his frustrations and anxieties about the corporate domination of the internet. But the average person out there has a pretty good relationship with Google and Facebook.
I want to say before we're done, the bad news in all of this is that Shirley Kressel is moving to Los Angeles, of all places. Our watchdog on Boston politics, including the development issues, is – I want you to do a sort of a George Washington farewell address, Shirley. Tell us what we got to watch.
We're lighting out for the coast, yeah?
Smoothies. I can't believe it, but give us a last word.
You know, it's part of this whole discussion. People have to try to remember what democracy looked like, what it felt like, what it really takes. It takes information and critical thinking. And it takes a lot of courage, and it takes getting beyond your own little interest group, and it takes an understanding of the structures that the founding fathers realized needed to be in place for democracy to thrive. You know, when Ben Franklin said a democracy or a republic, if you can keep it,
right,
he meant you. And however friendly we are now with our phones and our echoes and whatnot, somebody at some point is going to have to realize what the cost is, the real cost. And just the way that we have to realize what the real cost is to welcome Amazon in with or without a tax break, certainly with is obvious, but what they're going to do here, which we really don't know. People are going to have to start thinking more anticipatorily and less naively about the long-term impacts of some of these wonder things that are happening now that are entitling corporations to ride roughshod on us.
You know, we used to get very romantic about our precinct politics in this city, back to Curley and before, ethnic tensions, you know, but people knew where they were. It's pretty quiescent in the last few years.
Very quiet.
But can you imagine it coming back to life on social media?
Well, as you said, we're not there yet. We're not there yet. And we don't have a Democratic Party that should be playing that role, because they're, you know, purchased by the same bank accounts as the Republicans. But I think that somewhere in some long run, people will understand that their public realm has been privatized, that their personal information, you know, if you're not paying for a product, you are the product. And the real manipulation, I mean, I think people don't like to be manipulated. And right now they think that technology is letting them be the manipulators of their lives and their groups. And they'll have to see what actually is happening to them as a result before they start looking at unifying for some other. That'll be a real revolution, because it's so ingrained.
We thought you were going to lead it in our town, Shirley. You did magnificent work. I'm thrilled that you're in this conversation, and we are going to miss you bitterly. Thank you, Shirley Kressel.
Always the internet. I'll always be meddling on the internet.
Please, you can listen to our podcast, too.
That's right.
Thank you, Franklin Foer, Ben Tarnoff, Lester Spence, and Jim Ferrantini. Thanks to Maura Weigel. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, the great wit Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Becca DiGregorio, and Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our mother superior and tech mogul. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time on Open Source.